This is a podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Laws are things put into place to protect those within our society, including their reputation. This allows people the right to sue when false accusations and defamatory statements are made that harm that reputation. The Johnny Depp and Amber Heard trial in the US attracted worldwide headlines last month, and earlier this week, former New South Wales Deputy Premier John Barilaro was awarded more than $700,000 from Google in a defamation case. But Johnny Depp had previously lost a defamation case in the UK, and John Barilaro had previously settled a case with the alleged comedian named Friendly Geordies. And at the moment, one of Australia's best-known soldiers, Ben Robert Smith, is involved in a very long-running defamation case that, despite what the verdict might be, there seem to be no clear winners in that matter. Barry Goldsmith is our very special guest this morning. He's a special counsel and specialises in defamation law. Barry, a very good morning and welcome to the program.
And good morning to you.
Has defamation always been part of the legal system?
It has. Originally common law, meaning there was no act of parliament or statute. And during more recent living memory, it has been pursuant to legislation passed in Australia and elsewhere.
So what's the difference, let's start at the beginning perhaps, between slander and libel? It's always been explained to me that slander is spoken and libel is written, but are they both kinds of defamation?
They are, and the law in Australia now does not distinguish between the two. So now in Australia we only have that unified legal tort of defamation, but in other jurisdictions they still do distinguish between the spoken word, which is slander, as you've said, and libel being the written word.
So the libel would have been in newspapers, in magazines, in books perhaps. Would slander have been on TV or radio, or was TV and radio considered to be published as well?
TV and radio would have been published, but it would be a publication also involving the spoken word. So we have abolished that since the current Defamation Act was introduced in 2005. So for the last 17 years, we've not distinguished between the two.
Okay. But in the old days, just explain who would be slandered. Would it be someone that if somebody said something on a radio show or a TV show, or is it something that might be said in the street and heard by other people? How would slander operate?
When you talk about going back to the old days, it depends how far back one goes.
Okay. When they were separate, slander and libel were separate.
Okay. It was more at a meeting where somebody said something against someone else that was considered to be of a defamatory nature.
Okay.
That kind of situation, rather than in the print media or television. My recollection is there wasn't that much slander / defamation arising out of radio. Television obviously brought about a major increase in the number of slander defamation cases.
Yeah.
So more it was like at perhaps social gatherings,
right,
that kind of thing, or some sort of business situation.
So I'll get on to the more modern way that we look at it in just a moment. But libel, it's not easier to prove, perhaps, but it's there written down. People can see what somebody said about someone. If it happens in a meeting, and even today, that's part of the defamation law, if it's part of a meeting and everyone kind of remembers it differently, is that much harder than to prove slander or that kind of defamation rather than the written kind?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I have seen, because I've been practicing in defamation for, without giving away my age, almost 40 years. But that's why I've seen a growing trend now for a number of meetings to be recorded, whether in an audio fashion or in a video fashion. But I've seen a growing increase in the number of meetings now they're recorded because someone has suspected that controversial topics may be raised. So people now are erring on the side of caution and are taking that additional step.
I suppose it's easy to record them on your phone these days.
Yeah, absolutely. Both in an audio fashion, of course, yeah, and also in a video fashion. Yeah. Absolutely.
Who can be defamed? I heard that companies with fewer than 10 employees, you can actually defame a company. You can't defame the dead. That was always something. That's why a lot of people wait until someone dies before they say something nasty or write a book about them, perhaps. But who can be defamed?
All right. Let me deal with the deceased element first. That's probably easier to explain. You are correct in all of Australia, with one exception, and I think from recollection it's South Australia or it could be Tasmania. You cannot proceed with a defamation case if either of the parties is deceased. So whether the plaintiff dies or the defendant dies, any defamation action cannot be brought, or if it's already been brought, it has to stop upon the passing of either of the parties. So that is much easier. So far as a company is concerned, and there is some controversy in all of this, but we've had this in law now since 2005, a company that employs more than 10 full-time employees or an equivalent number of part-time employees cannot sue for defamation.
But if it's less than or fewer than 10, they can. In what way would a company or a business be defamed?
Happens all the time, every day. To give a modern response to the question, Google reviews, reviews on Google business pages. It's a very fertile ground for defamation actions by businesses.
Okay, so just on something like that, where somebody gives a genuinely held belief about, say, going to a restaurant or a takeaway, somewhere like that, that does have fewer than 10 employees, and they say, this is the worst meal I've ever had, the place should be shut down. How does a judge or a jury, or tell me which one would it normally hear something like that, if it even got that far, if that is your genuinely held view, have you defamed somebody, or are you just expressing your opinion?
Okay. The answer really depends upon what words are used. If I were to write a review on a restaurant tonight, this morning, and say, that is the worst meal that I have ever had, I could not be sued because that is my truthful opinion or my truthful experience. That is the worst meal that I have ever had. Unfortunately, a lot of people who post reviews, well-intentioned that they may be, a lot of people, once they start to post the review, the fingers get a little bit carried away and the words tend to get carried away. Spins tend to be put on the core complaint, and it's those circumstances that usually lead to an expression of concern by the restaurant or by the business, and in turn can lead to a defamation claim.
So if somebody tweets, this is the worst meal I've ever had, the restaurant needs to be closed down, and then somebody else retweets that or likes that tweet, are they also open for a defamation action?
Yes, absolutely. And the courts have made that abundantly clear time and time again. Yes, they are. And there is a severe risk nowadays about sharing posts, which of course is really, I suppose, it's a Facebook phenomenon, but it's not limited to Facebook. But a lot of people now, they just carelessly, even recklessly, they just share posts and they do not appreciate the danger of sharing someone else's post that is defamatory in nature.
So can that go across borders, for example? If somebody likes a tweet or retweets or shares a Facebook post from something overseas, or if they do it here and it's shared overseas, can that also result in an action? Can someone in the United States sue an Australian, and can an Australian sue someone in the US?
I have to give vastly different answers. The answer to the first one, can an American sue here? Yes, absolutely. The answer to suing in America for legal reasons, having regard to certain legal requirements, it's a lot more difficult for an Australian to sue an American.
Okay. Have there been cases when the retweeters have faced those consequences and have been sued?
Yes.
But not many cases or quite a lot of them? For example, if somebody said something defamatory about somebody, we're not even talking about a business, we're talking about a person, and then 50 people or 100 people retweeted that, can they all be sued, and has that happened?
It has, and the best reference I can give to that is probably the well-known judgment in a case of Dean Voller. Dean Voller was the young man who was detained in the Northern Territory.
Yep.
Yeah, he was subjected to really quite horrendous treatment. He then sued. And his claim, it's not directly responsive to your question, but he then sued the major media organizations, not based upon articles that they themselves published, but on all of the posts that followed the articles by the major media organizations. In other words, he sued on posts made by bloggers, I think the word trolls has been used, but certainly the word bloggers, and he sued based upon those.
Hang on, but did he sue all those people, or did he sue the platform that they were being posted on?
He sued the platform they were being posted on.
Because they've got the money.
Yes, indeed. Okay. And of course, a lot of the individuals who posted, nobody would have known where they lived. They may not have used their real names.
Right. And it's going after them. So, for example, in the Jeffrey Rush case, when that original King Lear article appeared in the Daily Telegraph, if someone had shared that on their social media accounts, would they be defaming him as well as it was proved the Daily Telegraph did?
Yes.
But Jeffrey Rush didn't go after any of those people. He only went after the Daily Telegraph.
Yeah, for obvious financial and commercial reasons. Yeah. If he had gone after the, without going too far into the legal esoterics of this, if he'd sued the individuals as well, then the court would have to have taken into account any damages that he obtained against the primary defendant, which was the major media outlet.
Yeah.
So the court would have to have taken into account any damages awarded against it, which meant that really there was no great benefit financially in going after the individuals who undoubtedly shared the article in question.
Okay. Barry Goldsmith is our guest, and we're getting a lot of texts from people who want to ask you a question. So I'll go through this. Gavin's got an interesting one. How many people need to have heard or seen the defamatory content for it to be deemed as defamatory? So if you're in a meeting, as you talk about, and somebody is defamed in that meeting, Does it matter that there's only one other person there or two people? Does it matter how big that meeting is? I'm not talking about something that's written in the newspaper that's read by, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, but in a small meeting of only half a dozen or less, does it matter?
The legal requirement is the publication be made to at least one third party.
So you could be in a meeting with two other people. They say something nasty about you and you could sue them for defamation. The fact that only one other person heard it and maybe they didn't say anything to anybody else, does that then affect the amount of the payout?
It does. Firstly, the essence of defamation is damage to reputation. So say that, for example, the defamatory words are only spoken to one person. Legally and rationally, it's unlikely that there would have been damage to reputation in the mind of that one person. The other issue now, given that Sydney in particular has become such a hotspot for defamation cases, as from the 1st of July 2021, New South Wales and most of the other states, a couple are still to fall in line, they have now introduced a serious harm test. And basically, any defamation case can be thrown out at any stage unless a plaintiff is able to establish serious harm. So it's intended to cut down on these very, very small defamation cases.
Okay. Paul in Harvey Bay asks, can you actually defame a state government department? And can an MP defame anybody in Parliament? I suppose we get into parliamentary privilege then, don't we?
Yeah. Firstly, to answer the first question, no, you cannot sue a state government department. Firstly, government departments often have statutory protections. But, sorry, let me vary that answer. Yeah. Some government departments do have various statutory protections. Yes, you can sue a state government department if a representative of that state government department makes defamatory statements, and if the statements were made by the individual in the course of his or her duties for the state government department. That's normal, that's standard employer vicarious liability, the employer being liable for the actions of its employees. So, yes, you could. Secondly, any statements or comments made in Parliament are subject to a defence of absolute privilege.
Now, absolute privilege has certainly come in some cases. I think the Chris Gayle case against the Fairfax newspapers, they said that I think they claimed truth and qualified privilege. So if Parliament is absolute privilege, what's qualified privilege? Because the Fairfax newspapers lost that case.
Okay. Absolute privilege is anything said, the two primary examples are anything said in a parliament, obviously federal or state, and secondly, anything said, which includes anything said in writing in a court case. So they are subject to absolute privilege. That's it. There are no ifs and there are no buts. Just on that, that's why you often hear politicians standing up and turning around at an opposing politician who said some defamatory words, and you often hear the politician looking around and waving the finger and saying, I dare you to repeat that outside
this chamber. Exactly. But you're saying in court as well. So if you are giving evidence in a court case, you can say whatever you like and you're covered by privilege.
Absolute privilege and absolutely, yes.
Okay.
That includes affidavits as well.
Okay. What about qualified privilege? What's that?
Okay. Qualified privilege is very, very, very different to absolute privilege. The essence of qualified privilege, this is the fundamental aspect of a defense of qualified privilege. Defense of qualified privilege applies where, firstly, the publisher of the defamatory material, and a publisher, when I refer to a publisher, and lawyers, defamation lawyers refer to publishers, we're not just limiting ourselves to the major media organizations. It is anybody or any entity that makes defamatory statements. So a defense of qualified privilege primarily arises when the publisher of defamatory material has a duty or interest to pass on information, and the recipients of that information have an interest in receiving it. And let me just give a practical example of that, because that was very much legalese, legal jargon. Say, for example, I'm on a committee of four or five, and I receive some information about the president, for example, that the president is embezzling committee funds. I can share that information with my fellow committee members because I have a duty or interest to tell them. They have an interest in knowing of that information. So that's when the qualified privilege defense arises.
Okay. But you could, if you had that information, put it down an affidavit and be covered totally.
Well, if there are proceedings, don't forget, most situations arise pre-court proceedings.
Okay, all right.
And could I just say, just on that court case, just to, again, to give a very clear illustration, one of perhaps the most common example of that is in a family law dispute where husband or partner makes allegations against other partner. It's in affidavit form, and the partner who is the subject of the allegations isn't very happy because there is a court document. That is subject to absolute privilege.
Okay, so one of our texters says, sometimes in relationships that are breaking up involving children, partner A may accuse partner B of child abuse and may state it publicly. It may be agreed that the accused shouted at the child and that while shouting was unacceptable, nothing further occurred. Can the accuser publicly state that the accused is a child abuser? If it carries, of course, other people might think, well, that was physical or sexual violence, when in fact it was just someone shouting. Is that possibly defamation if there's an inference by others that something happened when it didn't?
Okay. And that's exactly the type, and that question is actually the type of, or consistent with the example I was trying to give before. There are two parts to that that I need to talk about. Firstly, the inference. Defamation is concerned with meanings that arise from words. So you can either read words or you can hear words. And the big question is, what are the defamatory meanings to arise from those words? And there are frequently arguments, often very intense arguments, about what meanings arise from a set of words, because we all comprehend words in a different way. So you can have an argument as to what the words mean, whether they be in written form or spoken form. You can often have the argument, what do the words mean? So that would depend, firstly, on the words themselves, and secondly, the context in which the words are used.
Okay.
The second aspect of that I need to address, when the questioner talks about stating publicly, I would need to know more, what does that mean? You can say it in a family law document as an example. You can say that, my partner abused the children. If it's in a family law document, in an affidavit, for the purpose of proceedings, that is protected by absolute privilege. It's when you go outside, that's when you lose the benefit of that absolute privilege. And in reality, there are many, many instances when a party to family law proceedings files the affidavit, and then sometimes some time later either posts a copy of the affidavit online or repeats the allegations online, and that's where there's no protection.
Okay. Barry Goldsmith is our guest. A couple more text messages, but we'll go to a call with Jennifer. Good morning, Jennifer.
Oh, good morning. I have a question about trolls in the physical world that defame you and put it in writing and make fake reports and give false information. They're not experts. They might be just local community people, neighbours, people that know you, but have all piled on to create a hate crime that just goes into an avalanche. And you get, you know, sort of hit by it. What protections do you have? Can you publish those things yourself that they've written and said? And they've perjured themselves and, you know, it's like out of control.
Okay, I might just point out at this point that any advice that Barry gives is of a general nature. And, of course, in your own situation, you would need to seek your own specific legal advice.
Can a victim survivor publish the documents rather than the trolls and persecutors?
What, with all the allegations in them?
Yes.
Why would they want it, Jennifer?
As a counter-defence and self-preservation.
By repeating the same things. Yeah, okay. Barry?
I would have asked the same question. Someone who is subject to attacks will be very unlikely to want to repeat the attacks. So, Jennifer, when you talk about self-preservation, sure, everybody wants to preserve themselves. That's a natural characteristic, But people would not want to republish allegations made against them. When you say in defense, if somebody attacks you, Jennifer, for example, online, then you may, and I don't address the legal aspects, you or many other people would be inclined to publish your response. If you're just responding to an attack, you cannot successfully be sued for defamation for that.
Okay, we might leave it there, but Jennifer, thank you very much. Again, if it's something that's concerning you, you should seek your own specific legal advice. Grayman wants to know, if you say, I believe, or in my opinion, does that cover you in any way?
A lot of people think that if I just use those three words, in my opinion, or the two words, I believe, a lot of people think that that naturally or automatically provides a defense. It doesn't. There is a defense in defamation law called honest opinion. And for honest opinion, firstly, the words have to be an opinion rather than statements of fact. They have to be expressions of opinion. But you also, to succeed with the defense, you need to provide a little bit more information. And the information that needs to be provided has to be more of a factual nature. And the rationale for that is that what you are saying to people is, this is my opinion. And you're inviting readers to consider what's written. And I'll use writing as the example or the case study. You're inviting people to say, have regard to my opinion, and I'm inviting you to express my opinion. If you don't provide some factual foundation for that, readers will not know whether or not the opinion is the preferable opinion or the meritorious opinion. So to succeed with the defense of honest opinion, you really need to provide some factual foundation.
Okay. Di in Canberra has a couple of questions. Say in a review, if you say this is the worst meal ever and the chef is also ugly, you know, what sort of things get you into trouble in, you know, writing a review online? Just a you know, on Yelp or something like that?
Okay. Firstly, you wouldn't get into trouble for calling the chef ugly. just on that, and I know that, you know, that was given as a sort of casual example. Defamation distinguishes between words that, firstly, on the first hand, are abusive, demeaning, derogatory, and then words that are defamatory. So a common example, again, is many people call other people, particularly in a work environment, they call them stupid. That's not defamatory to call someone stupid. If it was defamatory, we'd need thousands of other judges. So again, to come back to the specific question, to say that's the worst meal that I've ever had, you can say that within, you can say that and you could not be successfully sued.
Right.
To say my fish was undercooked, and based upon my experience, I would not recommend this restaurant, you would not be able to be sued successfully for that. It's when you do diversify, you do put a spin on your core complaint, and you then move on to say, I had a bad meal, and also the restaurant was filthy, they've obviously not cleaned it, there's, you know, the sanitation issues very inadequate, that sort of thing.
There was a famous case, of course, where Leo Schofield was sued by a restaurant for a review, and he lost that case.
It was, and I'm just trying to, I won't mention the name, I'm just trying to think. It was a remarkable case. I think it, apart from the initial case in the Supreme Court of New South Wales, the case went to the Court of Appeal, I think, twice, maybe three times, and even went to the High Court on two occasions. It was remarkable. The restaurant, understandably so, perhaps, ended up going broke.
No, the restaurant's still open.
It closed. And then I think it reopened.
Okay.
If we're talking about the same case, there was a very illustrious one, yeah. And it was remarkable the number of different legal cases there were involving different appeals.
Yeah. Okay, John in Mitcham says, can you give an example of serious harm, and wouldn't it differ depending on the circumstances of the individual? Yes, it would. If you're somebody like Jeffrey Rush, if you're sued for something that happened in a theatrical production, you know, his career has not recovered since that. Other people prosper in the wake of these court cases, but somebody like that has not. I suppose you've got to take that into account. I suppose that is when we come around to how much money somebody is given or paid if they win their case, if they have successfully sued someone for defamation. It's about how much their career has been affected. Is that part of it?
That is very much part of it. Even at a much lower level than the Jeffrey Rush case, which is obviously at a very high level. The reason the serious harm test was introduced, and as I said before, it was effective as from 1st of July last year. Sydney in particular has become, it has commonly been referred to as, you know, the defamation capital of Australia, and also a defamation capital of the world, particularly as a result of the advent and the common usage of social media. There are so many defamation claims now that are being instigated, often social media posts, and we all know how easy it is to write something on social media. The courts have become inundated with a lot of claims of that nature. And there have been serious concerns that a lot of judicial resources are being taken up in what are generally regarded as being small claims.
Okay.
And that's why Parliament introduced the serious harm test. And you won't read this thing as being the intention, but this is what it was, is that what they're trying to do is exclude all of these, what they consider to be very small claims, often involving one or two or three people, where people are agitated. Everybody understands the agitation, but they're trying to avoid those clogging up the judicial system.
Okay, and that could be like this one. Diane Canberra says, can you defame someone in a private letter?
Now, if it's a private letter, the answer is a resounding no. As I explained before, defamation involves publication to at least one third party. So if someone were to write just to another person, you could write whatever you like and you cannot be sued for defamation.
But if that letter is then published in a book, the publisher or the author might be sued. Is that possible?
Absolutely.
Okay. RJ says there was the case of Bolton versus Stoltenberg and Loder. There was a case where Facebook comments made by Stoltenberg were liked by Loder. The court found that both Stoltenberg and Loder had defamed Mr. Bolton on the basis that the liking of the Facebook comments was a republication. Is that correct?
Yes, that is. Yep.
All right.
Bolton and Stoltenberg is a well-cited, well-relied-upon case.
Okay. Right up there with Donahue versus Stevenson. Now,
I think Donahue and Stevenson would be more commonly known.
Okay. How important is truth as a defence, especially in Australia? Can you be defamed even if what is being reported is true?
No. It's a defence if a defendant to a defamation claim can prove that, and I'll need to elaborate upon this, can prove that what is published is substantially true. One of the big issues about a defense of truth, and again, I'll try and avoid going too much into the legal esoterics. One of the big issues with the defense of truth is that you have to plead that defense to imputations or meanings that are pleaded by a plaintiff. So often words will be used, which we'll describe as being the statements, but they may give rise to other meanings that were unintended. And a plaintiff will then say, these are the additional meanings that arise from your set of words. And a defendant has to prove the substantial truth of those, as well as anything that is more obvious from the words that we used. So I hope that's not too technical.
No, that all makes sense. That's okay. Now, what about satire? We had the case of Friendly Geordies and the case with John Barilaro. In the end, he got more than 700,000 out of Google, which was a platform that was, I suppose, disseminating this situation involving the New South Wales Deputy Premier. Is there an argument of satire? Is that why comedians don't often get sued for defamation? I mean, the number of things that some very high-profile comedians have said over the years, you know, could easily be defamatory, but their argument surely would be, hang on, I was saying it as a joke, nobody could take it seriously.
Satire is a very grey area. It's a challenging area because, of course, what may be, let's use the common language, what may be funny to one person may not be funny to another person. So,
if you're a comedian and you're saying it to a crowd at a theatre and everybody's laughing, there's evidence that it's funny to a lot of people.
Okay, in that very tight little bubble. Yes, that would be regarded as satire or humour. It would be a joke, even if one person may have taken it seriously. So if it's clearly identified as being a comedic environment, a comedic communication, yes, then everything should be okay. But again, things aren't always confined to that bubble. And it's when the extra words, perhaps the ad lib words that are used, maybe that's when a potential problem arises. But yes, if it's in a comedic environment, usually it will be protected as being satire or as being comedy.
Meg in Hobart says, what if you write a letter to the paper, which somebody takes offence to? I mean, maybe it's pointless suing you if you don't have much money, but is it likely that you could be sued for writing a letter to the paper? And then surely it's the platform that published that it's responsible.
Well, if I write to a newspaper and the newspaper publishes all of what I have written, the newspaper is liable for its article, and I am liable in theory for what I have written.
So do people who write letters to the paper get sued?
Usually no. Firstly, newspapers, of course, have their own editorial team and their own legal team to vet anything that may be controversial. Normally, no. Normally, any complaints are made against the newspaper.
Now, following on from Greyman's comment, Graeme in Hornsby says, I'd like to know, what's the best way to phrase a criticism? Is it, in my opinion, based on my experience? It's really how far you go beyond that, isn't it?
Undoubtedly, the best form of protection, and people, of course, they want to express their views. The expression of freedom of speech is, so I'm told, still the cornerstone of our society. So you're entitled to do that. Again, words that are intended are often give rise to meanings that were not intended. So if I want to write about something, whatever it may be, a restaurant, a theatre production, anything, if I want to write saying, in my opinion, this establishment is not good. I went there and I found that the food was cold, or I found that the performance was amateurish. If you put that down, then you're not going to be able to be sued successfully for defamation.
But you might be taken to court. You might win that case, but it's still going to cost you a lot of money perhaps to defend it. What happens when a verdict is returned? Someone is determined to defame somebody else. Does that mean that it's been judged that the loser of the case was not telling the truth? Because we've seen cases, in high-profile cases, I don't want to specifically name them, but I mean, we could talk about Johnny Depp and Amber Heard, but other defamation cases where the judge or the jury has returned a verdict that says, no, that says you were defamed, therefore they're calling the other people a liar.
Well, they're not, in legal terms, they're not. Firstly, a plaintiff, like all plaintiffs in any litigation, a plaintiff has to establish his or her case. A plaintiff will present his or her case. A defendant can then raise an option, multiple defences or a single defence. A defendant can fail for a variety of reasons. And if you just take the Jeffrey Rush case, for example, the Jeffrey Rush case, the primary allegation was that he made, let me call it, an indecent approach. I think the actress's name was Erin Norville, from recollection.
Mm-hmm.
And the primary allegation was that he made an indecent approach to her. The media publisher that was sued tried to adduce evidence belatedly from other females who, in general terms, said that they'd been subjected to similar conduct. They left it very late and they were not allowed to adduce that evidence. So in that case, the court found, based upon the evidence that was before it, not the evidence that had been identified elsewhere in the media, the court found that the media organisation had not established its defence. But defendants in defamation cases do not always rely upon a defence of truth.
I mean, that Jeffrey Rush case is a fascinating one, and the fallout from that continues to go on. What makes someone drop a defamation case? We've seen that happen recently.
Well, we have the Craig McLaughlin case. I do not want to speculate as to why he made the decision.
I didn't want to discuss that case specifically, but in general terms, why does somebody drop a defamation case? Is it because they think they can't win, or is it going to be too expensive? Or they might win but have their reputation damaged anyway?
Any or all of those. A lot of plaintiffs rush into defamation litigation with an attitude of, the moment I sue, the defendant will concede. And often that is not the case. And then all of a sudden the plaintiff finds that he or she is facing a protracted, costly defamation case with some inevitable fallout, irrespective of whether or not the plaintiff succeeds or otherwise.
Do you think that the court is the right place? Expensive court cases are the right places to determine this sort of thing, that we might be better off with a tribunal of some sort that deals with it on a much lower level?
It's very difficult to answer that. There is, defamation litigation is highly technical. And there have been considerations given, I can't say to what extent, there have been considerations given as to how the law can be simplified. And at the moment, nobody knows an answer, or not any answer I'm aware of.
Truth would be a law... good example, wouldn't it?
Sorry?
Truth would be a starting point.
Well, there are many other circumstances where, as I've said, a defendant doesn't rely upon truth. And if you go back to that committee example I gave before, mm-hmm. I'm a member of a committee. I receive information from whatever the source is. I receive information and I then pass that on to the president. Pass on to the other members of the committee the information suggesting that the president has been embezzling funds. I don't know whether that allegation is true or not, but I do have a duty to pass it on to my fellow committee members. So if I get sued, I'm going to rely upon a defense of qualified privilege, not a defense of truth.
Okay. It is a fascinating part of the law, isn't it? And we are looking at some really high-profile cases at the moment, aren't we?
I've been practicing for almost 40 years, and the last 12 months, and I'll actually just rattle them off, the ones I can immediately think of. The last 12 months have been remarkable. Firstly, at the end of 2021...
I might point out we've only got about 30 seconds left, but I think most people know about, you know, Rebel Wilson, Jeffrey Rush, Craig McLaughlin, Chris Gayle, Ben Robert Smith. There's a lot more besides those as well.
Well, if you want to, salacious ones, overseas ones, for example, you've got the Wagatha Christie case.
Yes, which is a fascinating case, which we will in fact be talking about on the program tomorrow. Barry Goldsmith, it's been a great pleasure talking to you, and thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Overnights with Rod Quinn
on ABC Radio.